Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the award-winning Decoding Discovery podcast, where we dive deep into the latest scientific breakthroughs and unpack their real-world implications. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In today's episode, we'll be exploring a fascinating research paper titled Secure Data Out API, Enabling Encrypted HTTPS GET Transactions. This work was conducted by a talented team of researchers from Finland, Greece, Sweden, and Australia.
The paper focuses on a critical challenge in genomic data management and sharing, ensuring the security and privacy of sensitive genetic information. The researchers set out to develop a secure, user-friendly data access protocol that would allow researchers to retrieve only the specific genomic data they need, while maintaining robust encryption protections.
What makes this work so compelling is the way the researchers blended cutting-edge technology with practical real-world applications. Let's dive in and unpack their innovative approach.
The study began with an examination of two major initiatives in the field of genomic data infrastructure, the European Genome Phenoma Archive, or EGA, and the Federated EGA, which aimed to provide secure, federated platforms for archiving and sharing sensitive genetic and phenotypic data.
The researchers identified a key bottleneck in the existing data access process. Files stored in these archives are encrypted using the Crypt4GH standard, but to access the data, users would either have to download the entire file and decrypt it themselves, or request the archive operators to decrypt the file and re-encrypt it with the user's public key.
This process was not only cumbersome and resource-intensive, but it also lacked granularity. Users couldn't selectively access just the specific genomic regions they needed. They had to retrieve the entire, re-encrypted dataset, even if they only required a small portion of the file.
To address these limitations, the researchers turned to the HTTPS GET protocol, a data access standard that enables partial file retrieval. However, before this project, there were no HTTPS GET servers that could handle encrypted data. The team's goal was to integrate the HTTPS GET RS Rust server into the Genomic Data Infrastructure, GDI, project and extend it to support secure, authorized access to specific regions of encrypted files.
The key innovation here was the development of a secure data out API that could leverage the HTTPS GET protocol to provide fine-grained, encrypted data access. Let's walk through how this system works.
First, the client, which could be a researcher or a bioinformatics tool, communicates with the HTTPS GET server to request access to specific genomic regions. The server then interacts with the secure data out service, known as SDA download, to retrieve the encrypted data.
The SDA download service is responsible for managing the encrypted file storage and handling the decryption and re-encryption process. When the HTTPS GET server requests a specific data range, SDA download locates the corresponding encrypted data, decrypts it, and then re-encrypts it with the client's public key before sending it back to the HTTPS GET server.
This approach has several key advantages. First, it allows users to access only the genomic data they need, reducing the computational and storage burden on both the client and the server. Second, it maintains robust encryption protections by re-encrypting the data for each individual user, ensuring that sensitive information remains secure throughout the entire process.
But the researchers didn't stop there. They also extended existing client-side tools, like HTTPS GET RS, to support the GA4GH passport and visa standard. This standardized authentication and authorization framework further enhances the security of the data access process by verifying the user's identity and permissions before granting access.
The results of this project are truly impressive. The team successfully integrated the HTTPS GET RS server with the Secure Data Out API, enabling encrypted, partial file access through the HTTPS GET protocol. This not only addresses the limitations of the existing data access process, but it also lays the groundwork for a more scalable, efficient, and secure approach to managing and sharing sensitive genomic data.
What I find most compelling about this work is the way the researchers have blended cutting-edge technology with a deep understanding of the practical needs and challenges faced by the genomics community. By focusing on user-centric design and seamless integration with existing tools and standards, they've created a solution that has the potential to revolutionize how researchers access and work with sensitive genetic data.
Absolutely. The researchers have really thought through the entire data access lifecycle, from the archive storage and encryption to the client-side user experience. And by leveraging established protocols like HTS-GET and GA4GH Passport, they've ensured that their solution can be easily adopted and integrated into existing genomics workflows.
One aspect of the study that I found particularly interesting was the focus on partial file access. Rather than forcing users to download entire datasets, which can be computationally and financially expensive, this approach allows researchers to retrieve only the specific genomic regions they need. This not only reduces the burden on both the user and the server, but it also promotes more efficient and responsible data usage.
That's a great point. Efficient data usage is becoming increasingly important as genomic datasets continue to grow in size and complexity. By enabling fine-grained data access, the researchers are helping to address both the computational and ethical challenges of working with sensitive genetic information.
Exactly. And I think the broader implications of this work extend beyond just genomics. The Secure Data Out API they've developed could serve as a model for how to provide controlled, encrypted access to sensitive data in a wide range of fields, from healthcare to finance to national security.
That's a fantastic observation. The principles and technologies demonstrated in this paper have the potential to transform how we approach data stewardship and sharing, ensuring that sensitive information can be accessed and utilized in a way that prioritizes both security and user centricity. It's an exciting glimpse into the future of data management.
Absolutely. This research paper is a shining example of how innovative thinking, technical expertise, and a deep understanding of user needs can come together to create solutions that have the power to shape the future of an entire field. I can't wait to see what the researchers do next.
Me neither. This has been a truly fascinating exploration of a groundbreaking piece of work. Thank you all for joining us on another episode of Decoding Discovery. We'll see you next time.
Until then, keep exploring and keep discovering. Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a company that exists as a result of the Secure Data Out API, enabling encrypted HTS GET transactions paper. Upbeat jingle plays.
Are you a genomics researcher struggling to access your encrypted data?
Tired of downloading entire files just to get a tiny snippet of DNA?
Introducing Genome Genie, the secure, user-friendly way to access your encrypted genomic data.
With Genome Genie, you can selectively retrieve only the genomic regions you need, without compromising security or privacy.
Our patented Secure Data Out API leverages the power of HTS-GET to deliver your encrypted data straight to your fingertips.
No more waiting in line for the archive operators. Genome Genie puts you in control of your data.
And with our GA4GH Passport integration, you can authenticate and authorize access in the blink of an eye.
Genome Genie, securely accessing your data, one chromosome at a time.
Download Genome Genie today and say goodbye to data bloat forever. Jingle intensifies, then fades out.
Here is a detailed podcast episode transcript about the research paper reinventing the redundant target paradigm to distinguish serial and parallel processing of written words. Hello and welcome to the Cognitive Chronicles podcast, where we dive deep into cutting-edge research to uncover the fascinating stories behind the science. I'm your host, Tom.
And I'm Jen, your co-host. In this episode, we'll be exploring a fascinating new paper that challenges our understanding of how the brain processes written words.
The paper is titled Reinventing the Redundant Target Paradigm to Distinguish Serial and Parallel Processing of Written Words, and it's authored by Alex L. White, John Palmer, Genevieve Sanders, Janet Hussain, and Zelda B. Zabinski.
This study investigates a long-standing question in visual perception and reading research. Can the brain process multiple written words simultaneously, or does it have to tackle them one at a time in a serial fashion? Let's dive in and find out.
The researchers used an ingenious experimental approach called the redundant target paradigm to tackle this question. The idea is pretty straightforward. If people can process two words in parallel, then having two targets should be faster than having just one. But if word recognition happens serially, then two targets could actually slow people down.
Exactly. The redundant target paradigm allows the researchers to pit these competing models of parallel versus serial processing against each other. And what's really clever is that they don't just look at response times, but also carefully analyze the accuracy of people's responses.
That's a great point. Most previous studies on this topic have focused only on response times, but by also measuring accuracy, this new paper is able to develop a much more comprehensive theoretical account. The authors show that serial processing models can actually predict slower response times to two targets, even if accuracy is higher.
Fascinating. So how did they put this theory to the test? Well, the researchers conducted three different experiments, each with a twist. In the first one, they used a simple go, no-go task, where participants just had to press a button if they saw a target word. The second experiment switched to a forced choice task, where people had to indicate whether one or two targets were present.
And in the third experiment, they really mixed things up by including trials where a target word was paired with a non-target distractor word. This allowed them to see if the redundancy effects depended on having two matching stimuli versus just two stimuli in general.
Throughout all of these experiments, the researchers looked at three different types of word judgments: detecting colored letters, making lexical decisions about real words versus non-words, and categorizing words as referring to living or non-living things. This allowed them to tap into processing at different levels: low-level features, lexical access, and semantic knowledge.
Exactly, and the results were quite striking. In the color detection task, they consistently found a positive redundancy effect. People were faster and more accurate at detecting two colored words versus one. But in the lexical decision and semantic categorization tasks, the story was very different.
That's right, for those higher level linguistic judgments, the redundant target effect was either non-existent or even negative, meaning that two words actually slowed people down compared to just one. This is exactly the pattern predicted by the serial processing model, even when accounting for errors.
It's a really counterintuitive finding. You might think that having two words available would always be better than one, but the data clearly shows that's not the case for more complex linguistic processing. The authors argue this points to a fundamental capacity limitation in how the brain recognizes the meanings of written words.
Absolutely. This research really challenges the long-standing assumption that words can be processed in parallel. Instead, it suggests that at some level, word recognition happens in a serial, one-at-a-time fashion. The brain just can't fully process the meanings of multiple words simultaneously, even when it's trying its best.
And what's even more fascinating is that this serial bottleneck seems to be specific to the linguistic aspects of word processing. When it comes to lower-level visual features like color, the brain can indeed handle multiple words in parallel. But as soon as you start tapping into lexical access or semantic knowledge, that's when the serial limitations kick in.
You know, this really makes me wonder about the implications for how we read and process text in the real world. If we can't actually recognize the meanings of multiple words at once, that could have big consequences for things like speed reading or trying to skim through dense material. Maybe our brains are just wired to tackle words one by one, no matter how hard we try.
Absolutely, and that's a great point. This research also speaks to the long-standing debate in reading research about whether readers process words in parallel or serially during natural reading. The authors note that their results are consistent with studies using other experimental paradigms, all pointing to a serial bottleneck in word recognition.
It's really fascinating how this paper brings together different strands of research and uses this creative redundant target approach to shed new light on a fundamental question about human cognition. I love how the authors developed a comprehensive theoretical framework that accounts for both response times and accuracy. That level of rigor and modeling is really impressive.
Agreed. This is the kind of study that doesn't just present a set of results, but really tries to build a deeper understanding of the underlying cognitive processes involved. And by looking at different types of word judgments, they're able to pinpoint where exactly this serial limitation arises. It's a great example of how carefully designed experiments can challenge our assumptions and push our scientific understanding forward.
Absolutely. This research certainly leaves me with a lot to ponder about the way our brains handle written language. It makes me wonder about the implications for things like reading instruction, text presentation interfaces, and even machine learning models of language processing. There's clearly still so much to uncover about this fundamental aspect of human cognition.
Couldn't agree more. This study is a fantastic demonstration of how innovative experimental approaches, combined with rigorous theory development, can yield genuinely new insights. I can't wait to see where this line of research goes next as the authors and others continue to push the boundaries of our understanding of visual word recognition. Truly fascinating stuff.
Definitely. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you all for joining us on this deep dive into the redundant target paradigm and the fascinating mysteries of how the brain processes written words. Be sure to check out the full research paper if you want to learn more. Until next time, this is Jen.
And Tom, signing off. See you next time on Cognitive Chronicles. Are you tired of reading one word at a time like some kind of serial processing caveman?
Introducing Neuraline, the revolutionary device that lets your brain read in parallel.
With Neuraline, you can process multiple words simultaneously, boosting your reading speed and comprehension.
No more frustrating serial bottlenecks holding you back. Neuraline taps directly into your visual cortex to unlock the true parallel processing power of your brain.
It's like having spidey sense for words. Neuraline uses cutting-edge neurotechnology to seamlessly integrate with your neural pathways.
Just strap on the headset and let Neuraline handle the heavy lifting. Suddenly, dense academic papers, product manuals, even your ex's angry text messages become a breeze to conquer.
Don't settle for plodding through text one word at a time. Upgrade to Neuraline and experience the future of reading today.
Neuraline, unleash your brain's full parallel processing potential. Available now for the low price of 3 easy payments of $19.95.
Call 1-800-NEURO-OP to order your Neuraline and revel in the power of true parallel word recognition. Operators are standing by. Here is the podcast episode transcript. Welcome to the Inquiring Minds podcast, where we dive deep into the most fascinating research discoveries. I'm Tom, here with my co-host Jen.
Hi everyone. Today we'll be exploring a groundbreaking new concept called Artificial Intelligence Quotient, or AIQ for short. This research paper, titled Artificial Intelligence Quotient, AIQ, was authored by Xin Qin, Jackson G. Liu, Chen Chen, Shang Zhou, Yuqing Gan, Wanlu Li, and Leslie Luyansong.
The core idea behind AIQ is that just like how we have measures of intelligence like IQ and emotional intelligence, or EQ, there may also be a distinct form of intelligence that captures one's ability to effectively use and collaborate with artificial intelligence systems. The researchers set out to see if this AIQ construct really exists and can be measured.
Across a series of fascinating studies, the researchers found compelling evidence that AIQ is indeed a real and measurable form of intelligence. Let's dive into the details.
The first two studies provided some initial suggestive evidence for the existence of AIQ. In Study 1, the researchers analyzed 19 years' worth of data from global Centaur chess tournaments, where human players use AI chess engines to compete against other human AI teams.
What they found was that individual chess players exhibited a stable level of performance in these human AI chess matches over time, even when controlling for the player's own chess abilities. In other words, some players consistently performed better than others when working together with the AI, suggesting the presence of a distinct human-AI collaboration capability.
Similarly, in Study 2, the researchers had participants play Renju, a classic Chinese strategy game, both on their own and in partnership with a Renju AI. Again, the participants showed stable levels of performance in the human-eye Renju games over a 6-month period, beyond what could be explained by their individual Renju skills or the AI's Renju capabilities.
These first two studies provided some initial clues that AIQ might be a real thing, but the researchers really put the construct to the test in Studies 3 and 4. Here, they took a more direct approach to try to measure and validate AIQ.
In Study 3, the researchers had participants complete a variety of tasks using the ChatGPT language model. Things like creative brainstorming, problem-solving, and decision-making. By analyzing how the participants performed across this diverse set of human AI tasks, the researchers were able to statistically extract a general AIQ factor.
Importantly, this AIQ factor was able to predict performance on a new human AI task, even after controlling for the participants' IQ. This suggests that AIQ is tapping into something distinct from general intelligence. The researchers also explored potential correlates of AIQ, finding that it was negatively related to perceptions of AI as having feelings or emotions, but not associated with personality traits or prior AI experience.
The researchers really cemented the validity of AIQ in Study 4. Not only did they replicate the key findings from Study 3 in a larger sample, but they also showed that the extracted AIQ factor could predict performance not just on a new task using the same AI, but also on a task using a completely different AI system a week later.
This is a powerful demonstration of both the concurrent and prospective validity of AIQ. It's not just about being good with one specific AI, but rather a more general capability to effectively leverage the complementary strengths of humans and artificial intelligence across diverse contexts.
The implications of this research are really quite profound. By establishing AIQ as a distinct form of intelligence, the authors have opened up a whole new frontier for how we think about human abilities in the age of AI. Individuals with high AIQ may be particularly suited for jobs and tasks that require seamless human-AI collaboration.
Educators could also potentially develop training programs to help cultivate AIQ from an early age, ensuring that people are equipped to thrive in an AI-driven world. And policymakers could use these insights to develop initiatives that increase access to AI education, promoting more equitable opportunities.
What I find most exciting is how this research challenges the common assumption that human AI performance is simply a function of the AI's own capabilities or the human's own skills. Instead, the authors show there is a unique human AI complementarity that some people are simply better at recognizing and harnessing.
Absolutely. This really opens up a new window into the complex interplay between human and artificial intelligence. I'm curious to see what other types of evidence the researchers could uncover to further validate the AIQ construct, and how future studies might explore the developmental and contextual factors that shape this ability.
Me too. There's clearly a lot more to unpack here, but this is a really exciting first step. The idea of AIQ is a game changer for how we think about intelligence and human potential in the AI age. I can't wait to see where this line of research goes next.
Agreed. This has been a fascinating deep dive into a cutting-edge new concept. Thanks for joining us today. I'm sure our listeners are as intrigued by AIQ as we are. Until next time, keep exploring those inquiring minds.
See you next episode. Are you tired of feeling like a human relic in the age of AI?
Introducing Teleportation, the world's first teleportation service powered by artificial intelligence.
With Teleportation, you can instantly transport yourself to any location, all while seamlessly collaborating with our state-of-the-art AI navigational systems.
No more traffic jams, no more airports, just you, the AI, and the power of instantaneous travel. Our AIQ-optimized algorithms ensure a frictionless, personalized teleportation experience every time.
Simply think about where you want to go, and our AI will do the rest. It's like having your own personal genie, but instead of granting wishes, we grant the ability to bend the laws of physics.
Don't be a human stuck in the past. Upgrade to Teleport Aition and become the ultimate human AI centaur of the future. Visit teleportaition.com to learn more and book your first teleportation today.
Teleport Aition, the only way to travel in the 22nd century.
In a whisper, terms and conditions may include disintegration, molecular rearrangement, and a tiny chance of ending up in the wrong dimension. But hey, what's a little cosmic uncertainty between friends?
Here is the podcast episode transcript. Hello and welcome to Illuminating Research, the podcast that delves into the fascinating world of cutting-edge science. I'm Tom, and joining me as always is my co-host, Jen.
Hi everyone. In this episode, we're excited to explore a research paper that sheds light on how children develop their language skills over time. The paper is titled The CDI in Two Longitudinal Datasets: Methods and Differences Across Decades, and was authored by Trevor K. M. Day, Ariel Borowski, Donna Thal, and Jed T. Ellison.
This is a really interesting study that takes a deep dive into the MacArthur-Bates Communicative Development Inventories, or CDI for short. The CDI is a widely used tool that allows parents to report on their child's language acquisition, tracking everything from first words to early sentence structure.
Exactly, and the researchers in this paper looked at CDI data from two different longitudinal studies, spanning several decades. Their goal was to develop new analytical methods to better understand the trajectory of vocabulary growth in young children.
One of the key challenges they faced is that the CDI has an upper limit on the number of words it can capture. Once a child reaches a certain level of language development, the CDI essentially maxes out and can't fully account for the growing vocabulary.
Right, and that's where the researchers got creative. They developed a way to project CDI scores from the earlier words and gesture section onto the later words and sentences section, allowing them to better track a child's language growth even after they surpass the CDI's limits.
That's a really clever approach. And to tackle the issue of variable sampling across their two longitudinal datasets, the researchers turned to an advanced statistical technique called Gompertz growth curves. Can you explain a bit more about how those work, Jen?
Absolutely. Gompertz curves are a type of nonlinear growth model that can capture the typically S-shaped trajectory of language development. Unlike linear or logistic models, Gompertz curves allow the researchers to account for the fact that vocabulary growth starts out slow, then accelerates rapidly, and eventually levels off as children approach the limits of the CDI.
I see. So it provides a more nuanced way to model that vocabulary spurt that's so characteristic of early language learning. And the cool thing is that the Gompertz model gives you a handy growth rate parameter that you can use to compare development across different groups of children, even if the data was collected at different time points.
Exactly. That's a really important advantage, since the two longitudinal datasets the researchers used had somewhat different sampling schedules. By fitting Gompertz curves, they were able to extract a growth rate for each child and then compare those rates between their typically developing participants and a group of children with developmental diagnoses.
And what did they find?
Well, the results were pretty fascinating. The researchers showed that the children with developmental diagnoses had significantly lower vocabulary growth rates compared to the typically developing kids. This suggests that the Gompertz growth curve approach could be a really useful tool for identifying atypical language trajectories at a very early age.
That's a really impactful finding. Being able to detect language delays or differences in development early on could be hugely beneficial for getting those children the support and interventions they need.
Absolutely. And beyond the practical applications, I thought the methodological innovations in this paper were really clever and insightful. Developing ways to bridge the gap between the CDI's word inventory limits and a child's actual vocabulary knowledge is a major contribution.
I agree. This is the kind of work that really pushes forward our scientific understanding of language acquisition. The researchers took a widely used assessment tool and found innovative ways to extract even more valuable information from it.
Definitely. And I think what I found most compelling was how they blended sophisticated statistical techniques with a deep appreciation for the real-world challenges of longitudinal language research. They weren't just doing math for math's sake. They were tackling genuine problems that researchers face when trying to study this critical aspect of child development.
Well said. This paper is a great example of how rigorous, thoughtful science can illuminate crucial aspects of the human experience. In this case, the awe-inspiring process of how children learn to communicate. I really enjoyed diving into this work with you, Jen. Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Just that I'm continually amazed by the creativity and dedication of researchers who work to uncover the mysteries of language development. Studies like this one not only advance our theoretical understanding, but also have the potential to make a real difference in the lives of children and families. It's such important, impactful work.
Couldn't agree more. Thanks everyone for joining us on this exploration of the CDI in two longitudinal datasets. Be sure to check out the show notes for a link to the full paper. Until next time, keep exploring.
Bye for now.
Are you tired of trying to keep up with your child's ever-expanding vocabulary? Do you wish you had a crystal ball to predict their language development milestones?
Introducing Growth Vision, the cutting-edge technology born from groundbreaking research on the MacArthur-Bates Communicative Development Inventories.
Growth Vision uses advanced Gompertz growth curves to track your little one's language skills, projecting their vocabulary explosion years into the future.
Know when to expect those first words, the chatty toddler phase, and the moment they start correcting your grammar, all with uncanny accuracy.
Growth Vision, because the only thing more shocking than your child's rapid language development is your ability to predict it.
Growth Vision, unlocking the future of family planning, one word at a time. Available now at your local child development center.
Growth Vision, because you don't need a crystal ball when you've got a Gompertz curve. Here is a detailed podcast episode transcript about the research paper Metacognitive Awareness of Memory Distortion During Recall. Welcome to the Cognition Corner podcast, where we dive deep into the latest mind-bending research. I'm Tom.
And I'm Jen. In this episode, we're exploring a fascinating study that sheds light on how our memories can be distorted, and whether we're even aware of it.
The paper we'll be discussing is titled Metacognitive Awareness of Memory Distortion During Recall, and it's authored by Caspar Keren, Yiming Zhao, and Benjamin Griffiths.
This research tackles a really intriguing question. When we recall a past event, are we aware that our memory might not be perfectly accurate? The findings suggest that we do have some sense that our recollections can be skewed, even if we don't realize exactly how.
That's right. The researchers conducted a series of experiments where participants learned associations between objects and either colors or spatial locations. Then, when they were later asked to recall those details, the team found that the participants' memories were often biased towards prototypical or average responses.
Prototypes are these kinds of mental templates that we have. For example, if you think of a chair, you might imagine a prototypical chair design, even though real chairs come in all sorts of shapes and sizes. It turns out these prototypes can subtly distort our memories without us even realizing it.
Exactly. And the really interesting part is that the researchers found that the more prototypical a participant's response was, the less confident they tended to be about it. This suggests that we have some implicit sense that our memories aren't always accurate, even if we can't put our finger on exactly why.
To unpack this, let's dive into the details of how the researchers designed their experiments. In the first one, participants were shown a series of colored objects and asked to remember the color of each one. Then, during the recall phase, they'd see the object again and have to select the color from a color wheel.
The researchers used a clever machine learning technique to determine each participant's prototype color, essentially, the average or most typical color they associated with each object. Then they measured how close each of the participants' recalled colors was to their individual prototype.
And that's where the fascinating finding comes in. The farther a participant's recalled color was from their prototype, the more confident they tended to be in their response. Conversely, the closer it was to the prototype, the less confidence they reported.
It's like our memories have this built-in distortion towards the average or typical. But we have an intuitive sense that those prototypical memories aren't as reliable. There's this interesting tension between what our minds are naturally inclined to remember, and our awareness that those memories might not be 100% accurate.
Exactly. The researchers ran several follow-up experiments to really nail down this effect. For example, they had participants learn object location pairings instead of object color, and found the same pattern. The more prototypical the recalled location, the less confident the participant was.
That's a great point. The fact that they replicated the findings across different types of associations, like colors and spatial locations, suggests this is a fundamental feature of how our memory systems work. Our minds seem to have this built-in tendency to gravitate towards prototypes, but we can sense, on some level, when those prototypes are distorting our recall.
It really makes you wonder about the role of prototypes in memory more broadly. If they're shaping our recollections without our full awareness, what other ways might they be influencing how we remember the past? And are there ways we can try to counteract that prototype bias?
Those are great questions. The researchers also explored whether the reduced confidence was driving the prototype bias, or if it was the other way around, the prototype bias leading to lower confidence. Their findings suggest it's the latter. It's the prototypical nature of the memory trace itself that undermines our confidence, rather than a lack of confidence making us rely more on prototypes.
That's a really important distinction. It means this isn't just a quirk of how our memory works, but actually reflects a deeper metacognitive awareness. We have some implicit sense that prototypical memories aren't as trustworthy, even if we can't always articulate why.
Absolutely. This study really highlights the complex interplay between the information stored in our memories and our subjective sense of how reliable that information is. Our minds are doing all sorts of sophisticated processing behind the scenes, and this research gives us a window into that process.
It's a great example of how rigorous, thoughtful experiments can shed light on the hidden workings of cognition. By carefully measuring things like confidence ratings and prototype distances, the researchers were able to uncover this intriguing metacognitive phenomenon that we likely experience all the time without even realizing it.
Definitely. And the implications are quite far-reaching. If we have this built-in awareness that prototypical memories are less accurate, it could help explain things like eyewitness testimony errors, where a witness recollection gets nudged towards a stereotypical criminal face. Or it might inform how we approach our own memories of the past and the inherent uncertainties involved.
Absolutely. This study really gets at the heart of how our memory systems function, not as perfect recorders, but as reconstructive processes shaped by all sorts of factors, both cognitive and metacognitive. It's a humbling reminder that our memories are fallible, but also fascinating to see the ways our minds try to monitor and account for that fallibility.
Well said. This was a truly enlightening dive into some cutting-edge memory research. It's amazing to see how sophisticated our metacognitive abilities can be, even when it comes to something as fundamental as recalling the past.
Definitely. There's still so much to learn about the dynamics between memory, prototypes, and metacognition. But studies like this one are pushing the boundaries of our understanding in really exciting ways. I can't wait to see what other insights emerge from this line of research.
Me too. Thanks for joining us on this exploration of metacognitive awareness of memory distortion during recall. It was a pleasure diving into this fascinating paper with you.
Absolutely. Until next time, keep exploring the mysteries of the mind.
Here is a funny, weird, and concise commercial for a company that results from the research paper Metacognitive Awareness of Memory Distortion During Recall. Are your memories as fuzzy as a peach?
Tired of constantly second-guessing what really happened in the past?
Introducing PrototypeMemories.com,
the one-stop shop for all your memory needs.
At PrototypeMemories.com, we take your hazy recollections and infuse them with the crisp clarity of our patented prototypes.
Worried that you can't trust your own memory? Let our advanced algorithms rewrite your past with 20/20 hindsight.
Did your friend borrow your favorite shirt and claim they've never seen it before? Not anymore.
PrototypeMemories.com will implant the perfect, prototypical memory of them wearing it.
Forgot your anniversary? No problem. We'll give you a freshly minted, confidence-boosting recollection of the most romantic date night ever.
So stop doubting yourself and start living the perfect past you deserve. Visit PrototypeMemories.com today.
PrototypeMemories.com. Because your mind deserves a makeover.